growth, so we call them seven precious substances. You'll see Tony Dapashidu lists them there. There's gold, silver, emerald. You know, basically, if you fill up a whole planet, if you cover the whole planet with those things and offer them to someone, would that be a lot of good virtue? Would that be a good karma? And it's not just one planet. It's a lot. So first I'm going to tell you how many planets that is. Who is it? Written by who? Vasubandhu. When? Yeah, you guys are not funny anymore. It outlines, the third chapter is devoted to what the universe looks like, space and time. And it's really great. And who lives in the universe? So there's a very long discussion in the beginning about all the different realms in the planet, the six different types of beings. Towards the middle of the chapter, they get into Bardos. How do you prove a Bardo exists? What does a Bardo look like? You know, how long does it last? You know, things like that. And then at the end of the third chapter, there's some beautiful parts about how do you measure space? How do you measure time? And space, they do, they have different numbers up to 10 with 60 zeros. Every 10 has a different name. And they count it up to 10 to the 60th power. And then atomic levels, they start with a lice egg. And then they go down to a piece of dust in sunlight, in a sun ray. And then they divide that 100 times and divide that 1,000 times. And it gets down to subatomic particles and subatomic. Then they go backwards and they go up to the planet, and then the galaxy, the solar system, and then the galaxy, and then the universe, and then collections of universes. And it's really incredible. And then at the very end, they explain how this planet will burn up in a supernova from the sun, and the stages in which first the people will die off, and then the plant life will die off, and then the mountains will melt, and then the oceans will dry up, and like that. It's very interesting. And then some kalpas end with atomic wars and stuff like that. It's very interesting. So they talk about world systems. And the first one, can you see that okay? Can you see the red okay? Yeah? No problems? Yeah. Say, Dong Chi Pu.
Dong Chi Pu.
Dong Chi Pu.
Dong Chi Pu.
Dong means, is the word for emptiness, but in this case it's the word for 1,000. Same word, same spelling. Dong means 1,000. Chi Pu means general, a general type. And what that means is a world system made up of 1,000 inhabited planets. And that each planet is defined. There's a certain structure to each planet. There's certain beings on each planet. They're the same certain geographical things. The Abhidharma is very specific about it. Say Dong Dharma.
Dong Dharma.
You're welcome. Dong Dharma is 1,000 of those. So how many planets?
Million.
It's a million. It's a major system made up of 1,000 of these systems. This system has 1,000 inhabited planets, 1,000 planets with people like you and me on them. And this is 1,000 of those systems put together. And it's very interesting. I mean, they have examples where the Buddha tested his disciples to see how their clairvoyance was. He said, do you know where your mother is? She died, you know, 20 years ago. And I think it was Shariputta said, I can't see. And then the Buddha says, oh, she's on this planet 2,000 light years off to that way, and she's, you know, born like that. Then he checks, oh yeah, you know, it's something.
So what qualifies as an inhabited planet?
It does have those six types of beings on it.
I thought the six types of beings were only relative to Earth.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to tell you is that there's many, many earths like this, and each one has six realms. Each one has a hell, for example. But guess what this is?
So planets without human being are not counted?
No. But these are planets which are totally inhabited, you know, functioning like ours. They may or may not have the Dharma, okay? And very few of them have Tantra. So the ones where a Buddha has come and taught and where that Buddhism hasn't died out yet are very few. And among those, the one with Tantra on them are one in a million. So it's extremely rare. Our circumstances are extremely rare. What do you guess?
1,000 million?
Yes. 1,000 of 1,000.
1,000 of. Is that right? 1,000 of these. Okay.
1 billion.
You're almost getting up to deficit numbers here.
You seem to be talking about real money.
So I just wanted you to know in the text when it talks about a third world system or 1,000 of 1,000 of 1,000, that's what it means. It means a Tong Tembo. Tong Tembo is a universe made up of 1,000 galaxies of 1,000 planets, inhabited by people like you and me.
1,000 galaxies, meaning 1 billion, or no?
What?
1 billion planets.
You just said 1,000 galaxies.
Yeah, let's say if we call this a galaxy, you know? I mean, just for fun, okay? I don't know. You could call this a system, and then you could call this a universe. Just for fun, I mean, that's not really what it is. You could say a universe is made of 1 billion planets, and it has 1,000 galaxies in it, and each one of those galaxies has 1,000 planets with people in it. With people like you and
people,
me.
People mean human beings.
All six realms. Yeah. It has its own deities, it has its own humans, it has its own hell, it has its own animals. They look like us. They're very similar to us.
Could you state that again?
Each one of these planets, there's 1 billion planets in this particular kind of system. There's more than one of these. And on each of those planets, there are human beings that look like us. There are animals. There are in different forms. There is a hell there. A whole set of the typical hells. 16 hells and what they call partial hells around the size of those.
You said the six forms of...
Yeah, there's six forms of life on each one of us. Just like our planet. We can only see two of the forms of life on our planet. Animals and humans. So, the Buddha is talking about somebody who...
I bet I can see plants.
Excuse me?
I can see plants.
Buddhism, as it was taught in India, doesn't mention plants as being alive. As having mind. They're not included in the six realms. As taught in the Abhidharma, as taught in the Sutra.
What else is there?
Huh?
What else is
there? If you're going from the bottom, hells, craving spirits, sometimes called hungry ghosts, animals, humans, and then pleasure beings and almost pleasure beings.
Which are the demigods?
That's what they call, that's number five. Sometimes it's included into six and they count as five. Sometimes you see five realms in the Wheel of Life, sometimes you see six. That painting has probably five, I think. Is it five?
There's a there's six, I think. Not enough, but they can show you six.
Yeah. There's six realms represented, but only five divisions in the circle, I think. And it depends on which painting you have, and you can do it either way. It depends on whether you include the Asuryas, the demigods with the Suryas, the full gods.
What's that to pleasure beings and so going up?
Actually, before pleasure beings, what we call almost pleasure beings. And that's really what Asurya means. The Tibetans mistranslated it as non-gods, because they thought the was a negative. But it's a different thing. And what is the implication between saying someone who's supervisor and someone who's almost supervisor? How will they interact at work? So how will the person who's almost supervisor feel about the supervisor?
Jealous.
And that is the fixation of the what they call demigods. But the more proper translation is it's like near pleasure beings or nearly full pleasure beings. They're a little bit incomplete, and their whole life is they're obsessed with jealousy. It's the theme of their realm is jealousy. They're constantly thinking how to get. It's like the Roadrunner. You know, he's constantly thinking how to get at the. No, who was it? The coyote. Yeah, constantly thinking how to get the Roadrunner and always failing, you know. And that's the story of their realm. Okay. So you get a taste for that. Anyway, if you took that many planets, as big as our planet, and you covered them with gold, and you offered that to someone, would that be a great virtue? The Buddha asks Subhuti that. Okay. Would that be a great thing? And if Subhuti said, if they both agreed it was a big virtue, but then if the Buddha said, those mountains of good deeds, mountains of merit they call them, don't even exist, what do you think he's saying?
Self-existent. Maybe.
Self-existent. Do they exist relatively?
Yes.
So, good deeds and their results exist, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Then that's self-existent.
Okay.
When you say you take all the planets, you mean number one, number two, number three?
One billion? One set of number three, which means a billion.
Okay.
I call it a third order system.
Sounds like Star Trek.
The Abhidharma reads like Star Trek. A lot of the sutras read like Star Trek. If you read the Vinaya sutras, they are more amazing than the most strange novel you ever read. And they're true, so they're really stunning. They haven't been translated yet, but they read like Star Trek adventure. His name Depa?
Depa.
Maumba.
Maumba.
Depa?
Depa.
Maumba.
Maumba.
Depa means past, in the sense of in the past, already gone by. So Depa means past tense, things that are past already. It's part of the Tibetan word for nirvana, for example, which means what?
To go beyond.
Pass beyond. So what it means is the past. It's in the past. Ma, omba, what does, omba means to come. What do you think ma means?
No.
So what does ma omba mean?
Stay.
The future. Okay. So depa means the past, and ma omba means the future. Is the past gone? Is the future ma-omba? Is it yet to come? Right. So your good deeds and their future results don't exist. Even relatively. Even nominally.
Yeah.
The good deeds you did in the past are done. They're finished. They're gone. The results they're going to produce for you are ma-omba, not yet come. So they don't exist either. They're both non-existent.
But they're in the form of a seed.
They're past.
But the seed exists.
Not in the present.
The deeds are finished. Deeds and their consequences are... The deeds and their consequences don't exist. Right?
So you're saying there's no present then, is what you're saying. The past is gone.
The present exists.
You're saying the past is gone and the future hasn't come.
That's true, but the present exists.
And there's not no good deeds in it?
But by the time, now listen, this is not a joke, okay? By the time the good deed, at the time the good deed exists, its consequence, by definition, the nature of cause and effect, is that the consequence hasn't come yet. So you can't ever have both of them existing at the same time.
But
it's
isn't
impossible.
The seed a consequence?
That's a consequence, but the seed isn't created until the next moment. You do a bad deed and then it creates a seed. By the time the seed appears, the bad deed is gone already.
It's in between flip and flop.
By the time a seed produces a tree, when the tree comes out, the seed is gone. That's the nature of all cause and effect. By the time the result appears, the cause must be what?
Gone.
And if the cause is still around, then the result is
not
yet come. It's future.
This is applied to bad deeds also.
Every kind of deed, good deed, bad deed. So by definition, there's no relationship between karma and its consequences.
Huh?
Because there can't be a relationship between two things if one of them doesn't exist.
So let's go out and kill people tonight.
No, right? If you have a relationship, the two things that are in a relationship, the two things that are related, must exist.
Do they have to exist simultaneously?
Yeah, that's
well, if they're past, they don't exist anymore. If they're future, they don't exist yet. Does 1996 exist?
But they can still be connected in the present, even though they don't exist at the moment.
How can two things be connected if one of them is gone or not yet come?
You taught us that the karmic seed exists. It replicates itself each nanosecond.
No, but we're talking about the first moment of the being and its result.
So how can you have an effect if it's caused?
It's impossible. There cannot be a relationship between two things. It's like saying there's a relationship between this guy and his wife, but the wife's not around. There's no such thing.
I know a bunch.
The wife doesn't exist. The wife died 3 years ago. They have a nice relationship. You know, come on. You've got to have two. But by definition, one of them is always either past or future. They never exist at the same time. There cannot be a relationship.
There's a difference between saying they don't exist at the same time, simultaneously, and they don't exist at all.
Or they don't have a relationship.
Okay, nice. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that's how, in a debate ground, I mean, that takes about 3 nights, actually. But he did it very well.
Good job.
And I wouldn't give up so easily in a debate ground. We'd keep fighting, and then finally everyone would say, okay, he wins, let's go home. But that is the answer, and you get to it just by your natural instinct tells you that that's the way it is. So you have to say, and you'll read it in the reading, in general, they exist. You know, if you restrict yourself to the present moment and say that the future is yet to come, but past is not, then they don't exist. And there was a huge debate. Some of the major Buddhist schools differ on this point. The Savastivadins, the Tamje Yupa Mawa, those are the tradition of our robes. Monkhood were a Nabhadharma school. They said, all the times exist now. And then, as you go up, they say no. And when you get to the highest school, they say yes again. The Vajramikaprasangika says, all the times exist. All times exist in the present. Okay. Generally speaking.
Could you make that statement again, and then the interpretation of it?
You said it real good.
Yeah, but I missed the first statement, though.
It's just that, generally speaking, they all exist. They are, in fact, Tanya Thakpa, which means labeled with your conceptions.
What is they?
What are the parts of time that you label time? It's a very interesting question. How does time work? How does the theory of emptiness or the theory of labeling with your conceptions apply to time? What are the parts of time?
Past, present, and future.
Yeah, past, present, and future. Instead of saying two arms, two legs, torso, Mike the Monk, you say past, present, future. I take those parts and I label them time. So time itself is empty, and time itself could not occur without what?
Projection.
Without your projections. Without your labels. Time itself occurs because it is empty. If time weren't empty, it could never change, and nothing could ever move. If time were self-existent the way you think it is, the way you experience it, deep in your heart, it couldn't exist. It's also a gotcha. Time that could exist the way you presently think it exists doesn't exist, okay? Time exists as a collection of parts that you call time and that you experience as time because of what?
Projection.
Caused by?
Past deeds.
Forced on you by your past deeds. Which explains very nicely why...
Which don't exist.
Okay, so... which explains very nicely why time moves slower for certain kinds of beings. And that's reality. And you can read that in the Abhidharma Kosha. One day on Earth is thousands of years in hell. Because of their karma, they experience time differently. They take those same parts... They project a different label onto them, and they have the sensation and the experience of a year moving by in 1,000 years, and they suffer that way. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting. that explains how that's possible. You know, you had times when you're in a good mood and time flies, and then when you're at work and the clock doesn't move at all. Right? Yeah.
So you have Depa up here, which is the past, and then you have Maungkla, which is the future. Yeah. So what's the statement that we're refuting based on past and future? And this
some schools say, some Buddhist schools say, those two don't exist. Does Lincoln's assassination exist?
100 times.
Well,
1,000 times.
Well, what you can say, what the money means, past and future is, well, it is affecting our life now. So it's a local. It's a thing. It's a functioning object. It's affecting us now. If he had not been shot, that our life would be different. So anyway, in that sense, to bring us back to the subject, those mountains of merit don't exist in some schools of Buddhism. So if you were in a debate ground, you could say, well, good deeds don't really exist, and you could defend it pretty well, which would be a mistake. But it's also interesting to know how time is a product of your own projections.
The mountains don't exist in terms of conventional reality or as the good deed that becomes...
I tried to just prove that they didn't exist conventionally, and Stillwell beat me. Generally speaking, they do exist, obviously. Specifically, if you restrict yourself to the present, it's an impossibility. There's an emptiness there, too. So they don't exist... in that sense, conventionally, how do they not exist ultimately?
They're empty.
Like a good deed. Let's take a good deed, okay? Monday's not a good day for deep philosophy.
Silence.
I'll turn the heat on and finish you off. Okay, say Jimbapo.
Jimbapo.
Jimbeyu.
Jimbeyu.
Jimbechawa.
Jimbechawa.
These are called the three spheres, or the three elements of a good deed in this case. Okay? These are the three elements of a good deed.
Is that what Jimpa means?
Jimba means the good deed, the first perfection. What's that?
Giving.
Giving. Okay? The perfection of giving. So we're talking about the emptiness of a good deed. Okay? We're talking about the emptiness of a good deed. As you do a good deed, you're supposed to understand the emptiness of it. You're supposed to see the emptiness of it. If you see the emptiness of it, it's supposed to be more powerful. In fact, if you don't see the emptiness of a good deed, it never will produce enough virtue to give you a Buddha's body. We already talked about that. So you gotta at least know what it would be like to see the emptiness of a good deed as you do a good deed. It doesn't mean you shouldn't do good deeds, it means you should increase your good deeds. And as you do them, you should see their emptiness. That is like enhancing them. And making them, it gives them the nature of taking you out of samsara. And if you don't do that, it just gives them the nature of producing something pleasant for you in the future. There's a big difference. Okay. So if Jimba is the perfection of giving, dana, Jimbapo is the giver, the person who's doing it. What would be a wisdom about yourself? What would be a good way to think about yourself as you give something? What would be a shirav way to look at yourself, a wisdom way, as you perform an act of giving? They say that when bodhisattvas give a piece of bread to a bird, or when they go and piss in the bathroom, it's such a good deed that it's worth 10,000 great deeds by a normal human being. Why? What's the difference?
They see themselves as empty.
Well, what does that imply?
It implies that they are labeling all these projections onto the events that are occurring.
We're just talking about the giver.
Okay, so they're labeling. They're labeling
so
themselves.
So how would that help? What's the big deal? You know, okay, pretend I'm not here, or pretend I'm just labeling Mike the Monk as I give you tea, you know? So what's the benefit of that? I mean, that's where most teachings on emptiness break down, I think. That's where most people go home a little dissatisfied. Say, okay, I'm supposed to see myself as empty, but I still got to get up an hour earlier and go to work today. You know, what's the use?
And the only reason you'd be doing it is to create better karma for yourself and become a Buddha.
Well, you could just quite consciously. Knowledge means, wisdom means, this is the only meaning of wisdom. You consciously, coldly, self-interestedly say, well, if I give, and if I do it with the right motivation, I'll create a paradise because I'm empty. This Mike the Monk form, you know, with the bony elbows and the bald head and the fingers, and I mean, I could change it into a Buddhist body with the right knowledge. If I had the right knowledge as I gave away things, I could change it into a Buddhist body, quite consciously, because it's empty, because it's a projection. If I change my projections, I wouldn't look like this to myself anymore. Can you change those projections willingly, consciously? We wish. It don't work that way. They're forced on me by, you know, past Mike, whatever he did, good or bad. And now I'm forced to see myself like this. If I ever want to see myself as something different, I have to do good deeds.
So how does seeing yourself as empty?
It reminds you that that's knowledge. If I understand that this form is empty, it means I understand that conventionally it's a projection. If I understand that it's a projection, I know how to fool around with the projection.
So the point is then that you will only do good deeds if you see yourself as empty.
Yeah, absolutely. If you knew you were empty, it'd be foolish to do anything else. I say to people, it's like reading the label on the cigarette package and then smoking, you know? I mean, reading the label on the cigarette package is understanding your emptiness. Once you understand your emptiness, it would be the height of foolishness to do anything but good deeds. You know? It would be really stupid. It would be self, whatever you call it, you know? It'd be like people who smoke and read the thing on the pack. Sorry. Okay. It would be some kind of...
So you see the good deed as being empty, and so...
So far we only got to the guy who's doing it. Right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you see the good deed as being empty, and therefore seeing that makes you what?
Makes you understand why you should only do good deeds. Because I look, who's giving this... who's giving tea to these people tonight? Mike the Monk. Well, why does he look like that? Why does he look a little better? Projection. He's got a lousy projection. It's a lousy projection, you know. So I said, well, how can I have a better projection? Maybe I'll just think of a better projection. You know, and you try and you still look, it still looks the same. And then you say, well, what really causes the projection? Well, my past karma. So how do I get a good projection later? How do I get a decent projection later?
What are you looking at anyway? Your feet?
These wrinkly rooms. I don't know. Yeah. Stinky socks. People can give me socks. I guess it's a hint. I can change it by doing good deeds. That is knowledge. That's wisdom. That's the last paramita. That's the only meaning of the last paramita. Just do it. Just understand emptiness. Then you're on your way. Jinbei Yu, what do you think is the second element in an act of giving?
The object.
The person you're giving it to in this case, okay. Jinbei Yu, Yu means object in the sense of the person who's getting it. What do you think about that?
Did you cover this in a Buddha course?
Friday night. Were you here Friday night? Did I do this already?
Yeah. Prior series.
No, we did it about karma.
Okay, all right. We are on emptiness and karma, this class number 5. Okay. Jinbei Yu means the person who's getting the good. So what's the emptiness to him? Who cares about his emptiness? What's the big deal?
To accept it is
the only means. He's empty too. He doesn't have to be what he looks like. What's his emptiness? I mean, there's a lot of elements there. Why is he getting this gift? Is it your generosity?
No, it's his karma.
He has to get the gift.
He's getting the gift because he's getting the gift because he did it. To see yourself giving it to him.
And no, more like, yeah, because he created the karma to see me giving it to him. Exactly, yeah.
or you created the karma to see yourself giving it to him.
Well, that's why I see him getting the gift, but why does he think he's getting the gift? Because he collected the karma to see me walk up and give him the gift. So in that sense, he's empty too. When he looks down and looks at, you know, Joe the student, he's getting some cup of tea and he can understand the emptiness of that. That's the emptiness of the person getting it. Actually, he's at a disadvantage. He just used up some good karma.
So what's the value of seeing it as empty, the recipient as empty?
There's a lot of reasons. I mean, if you really wanted to help him then, would you just be giving people money and food and tea if you understood his emptiness?
Is he giving dharma?
Giving a way to change his own projections. That's something nice. That's a good deed.
Empty.
And tea to tea to get him to come to class. Jinbei Jawa. Different scriptures have different things for number three. Some scriptures say, what do you guess? The emptiness of the...
emptiness.
Of the gift. But that's not what it means here. Jinbei Jawa means the emptiness of the act of giving. The emptiness of the act of giving.
Does it mean the act of giving or the emptiness of the act of giving?
This means the act of giving, sorry. But implied, the point is that when you give anything or do any of the perfections, your wisdom has to see the emptiness of these three things. Okay? Your wisdom has to understand the emptiness of these three things. What's one of the big emptinesses of the act of giving?
You mean big emptinesses?
Well, you could just say, what's its nature? What is the perfection of giving? What's its nature? What's its main quality? It's a good deed, yeah. It's a good deed. You can check. It might be for us.
Do I have to tell them to go away?
No, they're just late. They're just not here.
Oh, let them in and we'll kick... I won't credit them.
And then you kick them
out. No, I don't credit them. Look at how empty they are. It might be microwave with a bunch of old computers. So that's the emptiness. Now the Buddha says something radical in a sutra. I'll read it to you, just to prove it to you. I mean, I won't put it up on the board because you'd take this over. But you can just listen. It says, Dole. Dole means from the sutra, it says, Parchim dhammongabo de, shechim dhamjana, paratu chimbe ming mito. Which means, Parchim dhammonga, the first five perfections. Shechin dhamjana, if they lack the perfection of wisdom, Paratu chimbe ming mito, they don't deserve the name of perfections.
They don't deserve the name of what?
Perfection. They shouldn't be called perfections. First five perfections, if done without the sixth perfection, don't deserve the name of perfection. That's a Buddha, direct quotation. And perfection of wisdom in those five perfections means these three spheres or these three elements. But as you do them, you must perceive the emptiness of those three parts of it. What would it be in the case of the... By the way, we covered the first perfection, right? I'm just going to say P, okay? Since they don't deserve the name. First is the perfection. What's the second perfection?
Morality.
Yeah, morality. By the way, I don't like the translation of generosity because, as I said last time, giving protection to somebody is the first perfection. Giving dharma. I mean, you can't... generosity doesn't quite fit. Morality basically falling into three different categories. What we call pratimoksha. You don't have to know all this. You don't have to write all this. Pratimoksha means the normal morality vows. Okay? There's eight sets of vowed morality. One day vow for laymen, 10 vows for lifetime for a layman or a laywoman, and then five kinds of ordained vows, starting with a novice vow and going up to a full monk's vow. So, or just keeping the 10 moralities because you're a Buddhist. Okay, those are all the first level of morality. Second level, yeah.
I'm sorry, are the 10 precepts?
They're precepts when they are given as a vow. In the case of the second and third of the 8 pratimoksha vows. And they're precepts for a layman until he dies in the pratimoksha system, in the Vinaya system. But all Buddhists have to keep them. If you keep them without a vow, it's not as powerful. If you keep them because you took a vow, it's more powerful. And really it starts, there's 6 kinds of lifetime layman's vows, and they involve a minimum of 5 vows. Long story, okay? Second level of vows is the Bodhisattva vows. 64 vows, 18 and 46. And then third level is secret vows, tantric vows.
They coincide with the 6 levels of perfection?
No.
Okay.
Those are just all different kinds of the second perfection. The second perfection can fall into any of them. Okay, third one. Yeah, I like that. Perfection of not There's no good word for this in English, okay? Patience falls a little short, I think. Patience means the ability to wait in a doctor's waiting room, I think, in English, right?
I mean, what you are. When
patience means the ability to wait in English, I think, more than the ability, this is the perfection, it's a very, very specific emotional state that when the heat comes on you, and that means when someone pushes your buttons, when that one person in the world who knows where to push, pushes, you just let it go. You don't respond with anger. And that's the third perfection.
So this person doesn't know.
Oh, sometimes.
Doesn't know what?
Where is this button?
No, you know, there's someone in your life. Oh, I know who it was for me. I had a boss who just, anything would set me off. And, most people know somebody like that. And that means, it doesn't mean like in the heat of a nice tea that you stay cool. It means that when the moment comes, that one person that you really don't like very much says the thing that would most hurt you or anger you, you just stay cool. And it's accepted in Buddhist philosophy that that's more difficult than staying in a cave for 5 years and meditating. It's a much more difficult austerity. That's recognized as the highest austerity in Buddhism. That's considered the highest austerity. Much more difficult to keep your cool in that one moment at work than to sit in a cave and meditate for years. And the bad karma of letting it happen is much more significant. You guys have karma class, you know that anger, and you know in life that one good incident with somebody can ruin your relationship for years. You know, one explosion can ruin a sour relationship for years, and that's karmically correct. Number 4, what is that?
Joyful effort.
Yeah, I like that, okay. And you could say virtuous.
Yeah.
Okay, those are our additions, okay. Why do they say virtuous? Because it's not the perfection of effort to try hard to cheat people or to try hard to hurt people or to try hard to get money. That's not perfection of effort. Okay? Effort is defined as sum kangela tola o, which means the perfection of effort is to enjoy doing good things. And that's cool. That's nice. You just enjoy doing the right thing. You don't resist it or figure out ways why you should do it or shouldn't do it. Okay, it's defined as enjoying doing good things. What's number 5?
Concentration.
you can say perfection. You can say meditative concentration. Now, what's the difference between the perfection of giving and just plain giving? And what's the difference between the perfection of morality and just plain morality? We'll talk about that after you have tea. Okay? All right. Go have some tea.
Thank you. Paracchimba
is the Tibetan word for perfection.
Oh, sorry.
Okay?
Oh,
okay. Perfection. Like the six perfections. P-A-R-O-L. T-U-M-B-A. Ro means side. Who's Gary Larson?
Farsight.
Cartoonist.
Yeah, Farsight. The classic example is when you're standing on a mountain and there's another mountain like 20 miles away. That's puddle. That's the far side. You're on the near side. That's on the far side. The other example is like the shore of Japan compared to California. Like, if you stand on the ocean side at Malibu and look across to the... That's puddle. That's the far side. Way over there. Okay. Du means two. And chimba means gone. In Sanskrit, the word gone is ikta. And far side is para. And you indicate the second grammar case by with an M. So paramita.
Paramus?
Near paramus.
Is that genitive? Second grammar case means genitive or something like that?
No, locative. So paramita, okay? Paramita. Go on to the other side. Go on to the far side. Okay. If the far side is... If the ocean you're trying to cross is samsara, then what do you think paramita is? What would be the paramita?
Nirvana
and Buddhahood, okay? You can think of it as Buddhahood. Okay, the ultimate nirvana. I'm sorry, the bottom part, right? And itta means gone to. So I ask you a question. Does anybody really have param itta?
Buddha.
Okay. Buddha's the only dude who's got param itta. Okay. All right? Really, param itta means gone to Buddhahood, gone to enlightenment. So really only a Buddha has param itta.
This means full enlightenment.
Yeah.
What about bliss? When we say gone to bliss, is it the same word?
Yeah, that bliss means full enlightenment. Yeah. Okay. So paramita, really only the Buddha has paramita. But one of these perfections has the function of taro to chin, and then you cut it off here, and you say che. Which means takes you. Paro du chin. Instead of ba, you say che. Okay. Paro du chin che means the thing that takes you to what? To the far shore, which is Buddhahood, enlightenment. And that's the second meaning of the word perfection. So really, I mean, I used to always wonder about it. You know, why is it called perfection? You ain't perfect when you're practicing those six. You know, as they exist in the mind of a Buddha, these are actual perfections. As they exist in a Bodhisattva's mind who's not yet a Buddha, they mean trying to get to perfection. Something that takes him to perfection. Right? Those six deeds take you to perfection. They should have been called the six takes you to perfections. But I guess it was too long.
You said one of them is called.
Which one do you think is the real Paratatunsi wisdom? The real Paratatunsi is wisdom. The real one that gets you to Buddhahood. is wisdom.
So he's trying to get the perfection, or he's working on his perfection. Or would you say trying to get?
Yeah, it takes you to perfection. Mm-hmm. Perfection itself is a little bit of a stretch translation, right? Reach the other shore, but it's okay. It does give that sense that only a Buddha has it. The real one. And then the rest are just getting you to perfection. Although they're called perfection because they're getting you to perfection. What makes something a bodhisattva's activity? What makes you a bodhisattva? We learned it in a couple courses. What makes you a bodhisattva?
Well, that compassion linking the understanding of emptiness with compassion.
That's perfection of wisdom.
That's bodhicitta.
That's the definition of the perfection of wisdom. You're mixing up the definition of perfection of wisdom with the definition of bodhicitta wisdom.
The wisdom to achieve enlightenment.
Yeah. Sankhipani Shinichiri, another big time to do. Maitreya said. Bodhicitta is defined as the wish to achieve enlightenment to help other people. Okay. So, does that say anything about emptiness? No, it's just the wish to help. So, an action like giving, or an action like not getting angry. Somebody in the other class said the perfection of keeping your cool. Which is not bad.
Giving a cool, you can still get angry inside.
You can also turn people, shut people out. And
yeah, okay. where was I? So what makes them bodhisattva activities? What? Yeah. If they're done with that motivation, which is to achieve Buddhahood for the benefit of other people. Okay? Then that's correct. That's the correct answer on your last question on your homework. The thing that makes these the perfections, the thing that makes these bodhisattva activities is that they're done with the motivation to reach Buddhahood for the sake of all other beings. And the reach Buddhahood implies for the sake of yourself too, right? Remember?
Well, for a Buddha, it's their activity, and for a bodhisattva, it is the activity which will get them to Buddha
the
in the form of giving.
It's the why you do it. Okay? What makes a perfection, what makes giving the perfection of giving, is only doing it to help to achieve Buddha for other people. So if you're in a debate, I'd say, you know, why then did the Buddha say, if they're not done with the perfection of wisdom, what? Ming mi to. What do we say at the beginning of class? If you do any of those other five are done without the perfection of wisdom, without seeing the emptiness of those three things.
They don't deserve the name.
They don't deserve the name perfection. So there's this huge debate in Buddhist text ever since then. You know, did the Buddha deny that the other five are perfections without number six? What makes them perfections? If they're done with bodhicitta. They're done with the wish to become a Buddha, to help other people. So that's what we call wrong loop. That's the correct position. What?
Well, when you say if they're not done with number six, it implies two things then. If they're not done with an awareness of the lack of self-existence in all those
three, three
there's the second part and the first part, which makes it a perfection in the first place, being the bodhicitta.
Right, so the correct
really
answer is
two things.
It's not two things. Mm-hmm. I mean, they do deserve the name perfections because if they're done with bodhicitta. Okay. Bodhicitta is what makes them perfections. Now, it is true that the Buddha said if they're not done with wisdom, they don't deserve the name perfections. But that's interpretive. It's like when the Buddha said, kill your father, kill your mother. I mean, don't take it that way. Okay? It means he meant something. He meant that it's very important. But he didn't mean it so radically to say that if you're giving and you're doing it to help all sentient beings, it ain't the perfection of giving. Of course it is. That's what makes it the perfection of giving. Because there's a logical problem there. If I have to get the number six through how? What do monks in the monastery do just before they study Manimika? They study perfection and wisdom for 12 years. Then they go into meditation. They go in retreat. Why? I mean, they're about to study Manimika for 4 years. Why do they go into retreat? It's to collect virtue.
Yeah.
you have to collect some monstrous virtue to understand emptiness. But some monks, they go away from the monastery. Rinpoche did a very famous retreat before he stayed in Mandinika. He almost died. He went out and did this in a cave and did this retreat. In other words, you need the first five perfections to what?
See emptiness.
To get to number six, you got to have a heck of a lot of virtue just to get to number six.
I mean, it depends on how loosely you're using or how broadly you're using the word virtue. You also got to develop. You've got to develop calm abiding, or you can't. You're never going to see emptiness anyway. Right, but it's not just virtue, but without that.
Right, but mainly virtue. So you can't get to number six without what?
Without doing all the rest.
Without the first
five. Number six present.
No. Well, that's a catch 22 then.
If they're done without the perfection of wisdom, then they're not the perfection.
That's why they are not perfections. Just because they're done with the perfection of wisdom. Because you don't get to the perfection of wisdom until you do a heck of a lot of good deeds before that. You can't perfect the sixth perfection without the first five. If I say you can't even do the first five without number six, it's a problem. Because you can't get to number six until you do the first five. So that's not what the Buddha meant. He meant you have to enhance everything. So there's cause and effect there. You have to collect pretty heavy virtue to see emptiness.
You don't have to collect them in the same life span, yeah? So it may appear as if in particular life...
Yeah, it may seem that some guy is very special because he just tried a little bit and he's perceived emptiness. But then the Buddha said you've got to have perfection of wisdom for these to really be very effective perfections. And you know that because you understand the meaning of emptiness. If you don't do those perfections and perceive the emptiness of those three things, they're not going to be what? They're going to be wimpy. They're going to be feeble. You don't understand what you're doing. You know, people have urges to do good deeds. People do good deeds. It's very feeble. The virtue is very feeble. If you do a good deed, understand the emptiness of it. It's powerful. Because you know correctly, directly, clearly, how you will become Mike the Buddha instead of Mike the Monk, you know, if you keep doing this stuff with wisdom, with knowledge. You understand perfectly how it works. And that's the whole idea. That's why the study about it. Okay, that's good. I do. Yes, ma'am. So what did Buddha mean when he said they weren't perfect?
They were getting you to.
Without wisdom. He said that wisdom is very important. It doesn't mean wisdom. Without wisdom, they're not perfect. Buddhahood very quickly. If you don't do it with wisdom.
You seem to be under the impression, I asked you about the part of the reading that we did last week. It talks about the Buddhas of the last time, and the Bodhisattvas of the last time that are going to be taught not just by one Buddha, but by many Buddhas. And you said that you had gone over that in class, and yet I don't have any notes on it, and several other people that I've checked with don't have any notes on it.
I don't think I know that.
Oh, okay. Well,
but
nothing to say about it?
Tony Dapper doesn't say anything about it, frankly. I don't know. The main point there is that, if you want to go on about it, is that they have made obeisance, they've made offerings towards countless Buddhas. And then you get into, without Tantra, and without high teachings on emptiness. If you tried to collect the virtue it takes to be a Buddha, it would take 76,000 major kalpas. 75, 76, and 77, something like that. Okay? And that's how long it took the Buddha. I mean, the kalpa is trillions of years, so that's all.
The implication is not only are these bodhisattvas different in that they don't just take teachings from one Buddha, but that also they are superior bodhisattvas.
That's because they've seen emptiness directly.
They've seen it directly enough times to get to the point where they're even the subtlest grasping is being eliminated.
Not yet.
Well,
They may be Buddhists.
But that's what they're working on. I mean, that's the whole thing.
Sure.
That was the whole thing in the text about conceptuality, right?
Sure. He says, who are great beings, and that's the meaning of that phrase, is that they're seen as mystery. Okay, we got to move. Ready?